Well, welcome to everybody coming tonight. This is the first public event of Fathers Connect, and I welcome you all. I'm Elias Stromberg. I founded and am directing Fathers Connect. But, of course, nothing happens all by itself, so I want to say thank you publicly to Rabbi Itamar Ginsburg, who planted the idea in my head of having an organization. And I also want to thank David Schwartz, who's sitting here, for making the arrangements for us to have Neve Nof. They've given us the shul tonight for this year. And Renan Elazari for donating his time and expertise to videotape and audiotape the shiur tonight. Just on that note, the shiur will be available online at fathersconnect.com and will be available for people to listen to there. I would just say, however, the website is a work in progress, just like Fathers Connect is a work in progress, and it may be a couple of days before the shiur gets up on the website. But Bezrat Hashem, within a week at most, it should be there. Okay, before introducing Rav Lev, who really needs no introduction, but before doing so, I want to, first of all, I want to say that the shiur tonight is being sponsored for an Aliyah Neshama for Gershon ben Avraham Dov, his second yahrzeit on Avav Elul. So thank you to the family for sponsoring the shiur. Okay, I want to just explain, like, why is there a Fathers Connect? Why all of a sudden did we make an organization? So, by way of explanation, I want to tell you about an event that happened 9 years ago when a woman went with her Down syndrome son to an electrical supply store in Talpiot. And the young sales manager of the store, when he saw the young boy with Down syndrome, he approached the woman and he said to her, 5 days ago I became a father. We had a boy. And he has Down syndrome. The sales manager went on to say to the woman, my wife came home from the hospital, but the baby is still there. And he continued to say that his wife did not want to bring the baby home. As a matter of fact, she refused to even hold the baby. In addition to that, the father's own parents could not accept that their first grandson was not a typical child. And they actually were encouraging their son to abandon his son and leave him in the hospital. The young man, the new father, said to the woman, he said, Hashem gave me a son, and I want to be his father. The father did not go to the bris of his son. Instead, he stayed home with his wife, who refused to go. So the woman got involved, the woman who came to the electrical supply store with her son, her Down syndrome son, she got involved, and she was able to get a number of other women to come and begin to talk to the new mother and give her chizuk. The woman also was able to find three families who were prepared to adopt this young baby, still in the hospital. In addition, Joan Schransky, who was the founder and was then the director of Gan Harmony here in Har Nof, the begun for inclusion, she got involved and she was able to get the mother and father to come to the GON and to see how children with Down syndrome are learning. So, with Hashem's blessings, these efforts paid off. And after 4 weeks, on a Shabbos, the new mother and father walked from their home in Gilo to Shaare Tzedek Hospital to see their son. And on that day, the young mother held her son for the very first time. So, Baruch Hashem, you know, women are, Baruch Hashem, the woman's efforts paid off. But it was like women know how to connect. They're built to connect. And so the women made a connection with the mother. But there was nobody to connect with the father. There wasn't anybody whom he could turn to who could give him some chizuk, who could give him some ideas to what to expect, what to look forward to. Nobody put their arm around him and to say, I understand how much it hurts. Okay. That's why there's now a Father's Connect. That kind of a story, that kind of a situation. Baruch Hashem, Father's Connect is, you know, we are fathers of children with special needs. We understand other fathers. So, what are we going to do? How are we going to help other fathers? So, Father's Connect has four initiatives. The first initiative is to connect fathers with fathers. And we're going to do that with a mentor program where fathers who are experienced in being fathers of a special child can be a mentor to a new father, can be there and give support, give chizuk, share ideas, give expertise, let them know that it'll be okay. The second thing that Fathers Connect will do, or is doing already, is it's going to provide information that's necessary. I know a number of you are fathers of special children. Do all of you have discounts on your Arnona? Do you know you can get a discount on your water bill? And that Beituach Leumi offers you several days, may offer you, several days a year with which they'll give you some money so that you can have some respite, get a babysitter or somebody to come and be with your child so you can take the day off. There's a lot of information about our privileges and our rights, which many of us don't know about. Fathers Connect is going to connect fathers to useful information. The third thing is that a survey was done of agencies, of about 20 agencies here in Israel, which are serving special needs children. Two of those agencies have programs which they say are aimed directly at fathers. 2 out of 20. One of the things Fathers Connect is going to do is bridge that gap, is going to let the agencies know what we want, and it's going to work with them to deliver what resources and expertise and information they have that will be useful to us. Okay, the fourth initiative, the fourth direction that Fathers Connect is going is a very delicate one. There are many fathers, unfortunately, who never bond with their special child. For whatever reasons, but I know these fathers. I know fathers like this who are going through life either in denial or in pain because they just aren't getting any kind of satisfaction about being a father to this child. There are also fathers who want to bond with their children, but they just don't know how. They're not resistant, they just don't know how. So Fathers Connect is going to work to educate fathers, to connect them with the mentor program, for instance, will connect a father with a father, which will go a long way to helping people to learn to connect with their own child. Okay, four initiatives. We have, as I said, I made reference to the website. These initiatives are described on the website, or will be very shortly. And the ways in which you can get connected to these initiatives will be available to you there. I've asked everybody, if they would, to fill out a little slip of paper with your name and contact information. It's on the back table along with some ragolach and a drink. If you would, please, if you haven't already, fill it out so that we can be in contact with you. Okay, maybe I turn this off. One last thing. One last point before Rav Leff begins to learn with us. As I said, the effort to reach out to families of children with special needs is directed primarily at fathers. Pardon, primarily at mothers. Almost exclusively to mothers. There's a perception amongst agencies and institutions, amongst professionals, and even in the general public, that fathers of special children are not very involved with their children. That's a perception. The perception is that fathers are just too busy. There's too much going on. They have to learn with their chavrusas. They have to deal with their bosses. They have debts that they're dealing with. Whatever it is, but they're too busy. And it's very common for fathers to say publicly, "I am too busy. I just have too much going on. Don't expect so much of me." Very often, however, what fathers say to themselves is something quite different. Sometimes the retreat from involvement with their children is because fathers just don't know what to do. We're men. And we think we're supposed to know what to do in all situations. If we don't, sometimes we'll just do something anyway. Even if we don't know whether it's the correct thing to do or not, but just to do something. Sometimes what we do is we shift the responsibility over to somebody else. In this case, usually our wives. And sometimes what a father will do is that he'll do nothing, which often results in the challenges that he's facing becoming larger and affecting not just him, but other people also. I think we fathers have to ask ourselves, what are we really doing? After 120 years, we may have to answer some tough questions. Like, you know, this child was given to you specifically. this special child was given to you specifically. And what have you done to really help support your wife in the way that she's needed support? And how many times have you said to yourself, boy, if I really just, I know I could do more, but you didn't do it. And how many times have we just said, you know, I just can't do it. It's too much for me. And how much have we opened ourselves up to looking to see how our special child can build us? We know, those of us who are in the Parsha, it's a big responsibility we have, and there is a lot on us. Okay, that's what Fathers Connect is all about. That's why we started it, and that's what we're attempting to do. So I encourage you, please give me the contact information there on the sheet. Check out the website. We will let you know of all the things that we're doing and what is in the works. And God willing, together we can build this organization into something that really is going to be of service and support to a lot of men who can use it. Okay. I thank you. And I'll just, as I said, I don't really think people need to know who Rav Zev Leff is. He's the Rav of Moshav Matisyahu and the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva Gedola of Matisyahu, and has very, very graciously and privileged us to learn with us tonight. And so, Rav Leff, I give it over to you. Thank you very much.
Can you hear me? I don't think I need the microphone. Upstairs, you can hear me?
Rabbi, it's for me. It's for me.
Can you just... It's for you? Okay. Do I have to hold it, or can I... Okay. Okay, I want to... thank Mr. Stromberg for inviting me and giving me a chance to have a part in what I consider a great mitzvah of chesed and also of understanding the perspective that one has to have on special needs children. And I could use every schus I can get, especially as Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is coming up, so I thank him for the opportunity. Rabbis don't have too many friends. My best friend on my moshav is a little girl called Esti, who is a Down syndrome little girl. She's now about 14 years old. She was born on the Moshav 14 years ago. And for some reason, since the time she was a toddler, she has become my best friend. She would come when she was a little girl and at simchas or whatever opportunity come and sit on my lap. When she got a little bit older, she was the one who would make sure everybody was quiet when I would speak at a simcha or whatever. And we celebrated her bas mitzvah 2 years ago. At that point, I told her that she no longer could sit on my lap and no longer could have any physical contact, but she comes every Friday night to my house for a bracha and to give me a bracha. And I think I get the better end of the deal, and to get a bag of nash. And she calls my wife Bubby, and we are very, very close with this beautiful little girl. And just recently, another family had a Down syndrome child, a boy, on the moshav, little Ezra, was also a very, very cute and very special young man. The little boy is 2 years old now, had many medical shilas that came up in his early infancy. And we are very proud of both of those children. And Baruch Hashem, I think the people on the Moshav know how to act and how to relate to children like that. And I would hope that the greater public also would be able to understand how to relate, and not only fathers of special needs children, and not only Down syndrome children, but children with other handicaps, physical, mental, whatever they may be, are as much part of this world as anyone else, and sometimes need to be treated differently, but with the utmost respect and love and understanding that that's part of the Rabbanu Shalom's plan for this world, and it's a tremendous opportunity that people have to be able to interrelate with people with special needs. I want to start with a basic rule. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, there are no generalities in the Torah, there are no rules, and even that's not a rule. Ein klolim, even that's not a klav. There are only specifics in the Torah. So the purpose of tonight's shiur, lecture, whatever you want to call it, is not to give specific personal direction to answer any specific halachic questions, because each situation is different. Each situation has to take in consideration the person involved, the family involved, the conditions of the family, and many other details. And one would be foolish to give a general hadracha for any specific situation. So the purpose tonight is to give guidelines as to the concepts of chinuch in general, the concepts of why there are special needs children and special needs people in this world altogether, how to relate to them, and chinuch-wise, what is the responsibility of parents and others in the education of these children. Start with a very general idea of who we are and what we are. Many people think that we are bodies. You look in the mirror and you see yourself, that's who you are. And you happen to have a little Casper the Friendly Ghost called a soul flitting around inside of you. That is definitely not how it is. We are neshamas. That's how we were created thousands of years ago. On the first or second day of creation, we were created as souls, each and every one of us, and we all were in a spiritual world, somewhere under God's throne, whatever that means, and we could function very nicely in that spiritual world as souls. We could see without eyes and hear without ears and get around without arms and legs. But when we came into this physical world, we needed a spacesuit to wear to be able to function in the physical world. A neshama can't function in a physical world as a neshama. Similar to an astronaut. An astronaut, as long as he's on terra firma, he's on this planet, he can function very nicely without any special apparatus or special suit. He can breathe without an oxygen apparatus. He can get around without a pressurized suit. He can speak without a radio. When he goes into outer space, however, in outer space, so there is no air pressure, and there are no sound waves, there's no atmosphere to carry sound waves, and there's no oxygen. So he needs an apparatus to breathe oxygen, and he needs a pressurized suit, and he needs a radio to speak. When he comes back to Earth, he takes off that suit. He doesn't need it anymore. So too, as long as we were neshamas in a spiritual world, we could function very nicely without a physical body. When we came into this physical world, we needed a physical body to function. When we leave this world and go back to the spiritual world, so we leave the body here. Could be for that reason when we manifest and express mourning, when someone dies, we tear our clothing to show that it's only the clothing that's been torn away, but the essence of the person is still there. So we are neshamas. We are neshamas who are clothed with bodies, and those bodies enable the neshama to function in this world. If an astronaut is in outer space and his radio gets damaged, can't talk anymore, you wouldn't think of cutting out his voice box, his larynx, because he can't talk. He's perfectly fine, right? He can speak very nicely, except in the environment he's in, he can't express his speech because there's no sound waves. So he needs a radio. The radio is broken. Similarly, a person who comes into this world and there's something wrong with his body. So it's like the radio's broken. That doesn't mean his neshama is affected. His neshama is perfectly okay. Except his neshama can't express itself and can't communicate in this world because the radio's broken. Because the suit of clothing is impaired. And therefore, if a person is a handicapped person, whether mentally handicapped or physically handicapped, that doesn't say anything about his neshama. That's just the opposite. The Chazal Nish used to say that a person whose neshama was put into this world in a body that cannot fulfill mitzvahs or is impaired in fulfilling mitzvahs, obviously that neshama is of a greater level because it doesn't need the mitzvahs to perfect it. So the Chazal Nish used to stand up for handicapped people, retarded people, mentally handicapped people, because he felt their neshamas must be of a higher level that don't need that tikkun in this world. In addition, sometimes a person's body interferes and separates between his neshama and the spiritual world. It becomes a mechitza, becomes a partition, a barrier between his spiritual side and the spiritual world. This physical side is a barrier. A person whose physical side is handicapped and impaired, the barrier is less apparent. And therefore it's very possible that a person like that, his neshama is more sensitive to the spiritual world than a person whose body is normally functioning. So therefore the first klal is that mentally or physically impaired people, their neshamas may be 100% functionable, except they can't function in this physical world 100% because the space suit that they happen to wear, the apparatus that they need to be able to function, this physical world is impaired. It has nothing to do with the impairment of their neshama, or it does not reflect at all on the greatness or opposite of their individual neshamas. Secondly, why did the Ribbono Shel Olam create people like that? Why are there people like that? Why is it necessary? So obviously I can't give you an answer, but I can tell you that this world is made up of many, many components. One of them, human beings. Human beings are the purpose of the world. And there are no two human beings that are the same. People are different. They're different in what mitzvahs apply to them and what mitzvahs don't apply to them. The truth is that we are all, to a certain degree, limited. We all have special needs. No one in this world can function 100% without limitations. We're all limited. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives each and every one of us his limitations, his framework in which to function. And every person is necessary. The world is made up of many, many different parts, like a puzzle. And each part contributes toward the perfection of the world. And it's possible that there are people who are supposed to be in this world for 1 second. and that's their part in this world, and that's how the world reaches perfection. It's very clear like that, because the Gemara says that's what David HaMelech was supposed to be. David HaMelech was supposed to come into this world for a second and then leave. And Adam HaRishon gave him 70 years of his life. But you see that there's a purpose for someone to come into this world for one second. There's even a purpose for people who never come into this world, who are stillborn, who are aborted, or miscarried. There's a purpose for them also. There's a reason why the Ribbono Shel Olam wants those neshamos to come in that way for that amount of time, for nothing more. Why? That's the Ribbono Shel Olam's business. I don't understand why there are normal, healthy people in this world. I don't understand why there are handicapped people. Both of them elude me. The full meaning of each person, what they're supposed to accomplish here, it's beyond my comprehension, beyond anybody's comprehension. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva to a woman who had already two Tay-Sachs babies who died around 3-4 years old. And she wanted to know if she could utilize birth control, because the chances of her having another baby like that were very, very great. Rav Moshe gave his tshuva about the birth control, and then at the end of the tshuva he says, but don't think that you had those precious children for nothing. It was a waste. It was a difficult nesayon. I empathize with you, Rav Moshe said. But the Gemara says that Mashiach will not come until all the neshamos shed the guf. There's a repository of neshamos called guf. And all of those neshamos have to come into this world before Mashiach can come. And your having two neshamos that were brought into this world brought Mashiach a little bit closer. The purpose. Beyond that, why and why you or whatever, that's beyond our comprehension. But that there's a purpose, even for a child that lives a second. Surely a child that lives 3 years, for a child that is handicapped, that is mentally retarded, there's a purpose why every neshama has to come into this world the way that it does, and that brings to the perfection of the world. So there's a purpose. Do we understand the purpose? No. Do we understand why there are so many different people in this world, and why there's so many different goyim and all the Chinese and all the Koreans and the people in Africa? No. But that's the Ribbono Shel Olam made the world, the Shevis Yitzhari, he made the world to be populated by all different kinds of people. Each one serves their purpose in this world, and that includes every type of human being and every type of individual with all of the limitations and disabilities that can possibly exist. The next question is, okay, fine, so there have to be people like that in the world. Why do they have to be my children? Why do they have to be in my family? Why do they have to be my brother or my sister? Why do they have to present me with the tremendous nisyonos that having a child like that presents a person with? So here again, we can't know 100%, but we can know that there are definitely possibilities, and maybe all of them are relevant. Maybe only some of them are relevant in different situations. People need a tikkun. The Ribbono Shel Olam said this child has to come into this world. Why these parents specifically? Because these parents need some kind of tikkun. A tikkun for something in this world, something that happened before this world, beyond our comprehension. But there's a lot in this world that we don't know, and a lot of things that happened before neshamas came into this world, in previous lives, a gugulim. Maybe this family specifically needs this tikkun, this nisayon with this child. It's one possibility. Another possibility is that it's an opportunity. The Ribbono Shel Olam knows that this family, these parents, have the ability to be able to deal with a neshama like that, to deal with a person like that, and to bring out their greatest potential. So the Ribbono Shel Olam chose these parents because they're the ones who can interact with this child in the most perfect way. It's also a possibility. So is it an opportunity? Is it a punishment? Is it a tikkun? Maybe all of them. But definitely the Ribbono Shel Olam pairs up the family that can deal with this child properly, both for the sake of the child and for the sake of the family themselves. And the Ribbono Shel Olam knows what he's doing, right? And therefore a family has to be able to find within themselves how they can relate best and try to find out what is it about us that necessitated us to be, or gave us the opportunity to have such a child to be able to deal with. Just thinking that, you know, everybody has the nisyonos. Today I had a deal with some families that have children that are going off the derech. Very, very difficult nisyonos. Children who are not handicapped in any way, except religiously. And it hit me, you know, parents who have children who are Down syndrome children, they're never going to go off the derech, right? They're not going to have those nisyonos. So the Ribbono Shel Olam picks different people who can handle different kinds of nisyonos, and you don't want to know, right? Sometimes a family who has a child who's 100% normal, because 100% normal, the nisoyin of going off the derech, right, exists, and another family has a child who's 100% not normal, a Down syndrome child, a retarded child, a child that's very, very handicapped. The chances of that child going up the derech are very, very slim. So they have to put up with one kind of nisayan, but they're saved from a different kind of nisayan, and the opposite is the other case. Who knows which is worse? And who knows which family can handle this kind of nisayan, which one? Only the Ribbono Shel Olam. And he's the one who matches the nisyonos to the people who need those nisyonos, who need those opportunities, who can handle those nisyonos, who can handle those opportunities. Another general issue that comes up with people that have special needs children, and that is the following. How do you deal with the following Gemara? The Gemara says in Shabbos, famous Gemara, Yudom Midbeis, Omer of Chama Bar Guri Omer Rav, La'olam al yishane odem beno ben abonim, Shemishvil Mishkul Shnei Sloim Mila Shenosin Yaakov VeYosef Yoser Mishar Bonim Niskanu Bo Echov Nisgalgalo Hadover VeYordu Avoseinu Mitzrayim. A person should never discriminate amongst the children and give one child more than what he gives the other children, because Yaakov Avinu gave Yosef a little bit more silk in that famous clothing that he gave, that famous Ksonis Pasim that he gave Yosef, and because of that the brothers were jealous of him. He got something they didn't get, and because of that Nisgalgul Hadover, and they ended up selling him, and they ended up going down to Egypt, and that's how we ended up becoming slaves in Egypt. That was the trigger. How is it possible for a person who has a special needs child? The word itself, special needs, means he has needs that others don't have. And a parent has to spend an extraordinary more amount of time with that child than perhaps with a child who's not special needs. And spend more money on that child. And because of that, maybe there's not money left or time left to spend with the normal children in the family. How does that affect the Shalom Bayis? How does that affect this Gemara? Again, each situation needs personal hadracha and taking consideration all of the factors. Let me tell you two general rules of where this applies and where it doesn't. Because if you understand this simply and not understand it properly, it's absurd. Does that mean that if I have a daughter who is getting married and I buy her a wedding gown, okay, and I have a 10-year-old boy, I have to buy him a wedding gown too, because I can't discriminate against my children and give one what I don't give the other. So should I buy my 10-year-old son also a wedding gown? Obviously, that's absurd. So what does it mean? What it means is the following. I shouldn't give one child something that really could be possible for all the children, And there's no reason why that one child needs that more than someone else. All the brothers felt they were fit for that same ksonis pasuk. So if Yosef got it and they didn't get it, he was getting something that they also deserved and they didn't get. But the 10-year-old should be told, you don't need a wedding gown. I'm not buying you a wedding gown. Yes, Hashem, one day you'll be a chassan, I'll buy you a suit for your chassan. You'll get what you need exactly the same way that your sister's getting what she needs. Except right now she needs that and you don't need it. When your turn comes, you'll get what you need also. The second rule is, children shouldn't feel that somebody's getting something on their expense. Because they're getting it, I'm not getting something. And also, Achi Yosef felt, Yaakov is giving certain authority to Yosef at their expense. He doesn't deserve it, and they deserve that authority the same way. She's taking something away from them to give to him. Those two rules have to apply. Therefore, you don't have to give each child the same thing. But children have to understand that maybe this child needs something you don't need. And when you'll need something special also, you may not be a special needs child, but sometimes you have needs that are special. When you have needs that are special, you'll get it too. And in addition, sometimes the practicality is, I can't give my other children the time they need. I can't give them the money, material things they need, because this child needs it more, and if he doesn't have it or she doesn't have it, right, the outcome, the result is going to be much more damaging than if the other child doesn't have it. But I have to let the child know it's not because I favor this child over you. It's because of the metzias, because of the practicality, because of the fact. And therefore, I would love to give you, right, more also. It's just I can't. What difference does it make if the child understands that you would like to give him, but you can't, or you don't give him? He's not getting anyway. It's a very, very big difference. It says that Yaakov Avinu was held responsible that he didn't expose Dina to Esau's gaze, that maybe he would marry her and maybe Dina would have a good influence over Esau. So because of that, Yaakov was punished that his daughter was violated by Shechem. He didn't want to marry her to a Jew. She's going to be violated by a goy. So the obvious question is, that's the way people pick Shiduchim? That's what Yaakov Avinu should have done? Should have married his daughter to Esav with the hope that maybe she'll be mashpi on Esav? And what if Uncle Esav is mashpi on Dina? How could he take such a risk? That's what he's supposed to do. Says the Alter from Slabotka, no. Yaakov Avinu should not have taken a chance of letting Esav even see Dina for fear that maybe he'll want to marry her and maybe he'll influence her. And therefore Yaakov did the proper thing. He hid her away in a box. So what was the problem? The problem is that when he knocked the nails in the box, he did it with a little bit too much enthusiasm. He should have been crying and saying, I wish I could take a chance with my daughter, then maybe she could influence Esav. But I'm not allowed to do that. I can't put my daughter in such jeopardy. So I have to hide her away. But it hurts me that I can't influence my brother Esav. When he put her away, it wasn't so much because he was concerned about Dina. It's because the Rabbeinu Shem felt a little bit he's not concerned about Esav. And that's why he was punished. Person sometimes has to do something. But sometimes you have to have the feeling that I wish I didn't have to do this. I wish I could do differently. This is what I have, practically speaking, this is what I have to do. I have to take that extra money and spend it on my special needs child. I have to take that extra time because if I don't, the implications, the repercussions for that child will be disastrous. And it won't be so disastrous if I don't spend that money on my child who doesn't have special needs, or I don't give him that time. But I feel bad. I wish I could give. I wish I had double time to give. I wish I had double money to give. What's the difference? The difference is that when you'll be able to do the other, you'll do it. But if you don't even feel bad, then you'll lose sight b'chlal of how much you have to do also for your regular children also. So the child also should feel like that. That my father, my mother, right, have to spend that extra time with that special brother or sister. They have to spend that extra money. But they would love to do it for me, and then you can show that child when it's possible. Even when it's not all that important, that you, when it's possible, you do spend that extra time with him, and you do give him that extra money, then he understands that the other one's not getting on his cheshbon. The other one's not getting something that he should be getting. The other one's getting it only because it's like the sister who needs the wedding gown. She's the one who needs the wedding gown now. You don't need a wedding gown. You're a 10-year-old boy. If the child gets that feeling, then this kind of rift in the family doesn't come about. And also a parent can involve the other children in the family to feel that it's an opportunity for them also. That they have an opportunity to be able to deal with this special brother or special sister. And it's not a detriment to them, just the opposite. It's an opportunity. Again, children are educated by how parents feel and how they are directed to feel. And if you educate your children properly, especially from a young age, to appreciate the fact that they were given a special opportunity. There's a girl on our moshav who just put out a book by Menucha Press, My Special Brother. This is the sister of this little boy who was born with Down syndrome about 2-3 years ago on the moshav. She's a very, very talented teenager, young girl, and she's already put out 2 books under a pen name, not under her own name. And in there she shows this idea of how, as a sister, she feels what an opportunity it is, what a privilege it is, to be able to deal with a child like that. Now, you can feel that way, or you can feel what a drag it is to have a brother like that, and how much my parents have to spend time with him and not with me. It depends on your attitude. And a child can be directed to have a positive attitude if that's the direction that's given in the family. That's also very important. There's an interesting marsha. The Gemara says, Hamoneya Torah mitalmid. A person who refuses to give over Torah to a student, even the embryos curse him. So the Marsha explains, it's talking about a teacher or a parent that has a child that is not very bright, a handicapped child mentally, okay? And the person says, there's no purpose in teaching this child. What can he understand, right? It's a waste of my time to teach a child like this. So that kind of person, the embryos curse him. Why? Because it says in Malachim, teach embryos. Somebody who thinks that teaching Torah is only something that you can do in regards to the gray matter of a person's brain and how much he's going to absorb in his physical, mental capabilities, denies the fact that you can teach an embryo. What can you possibly teach an embryo? But the Torah is not like that. Torah is something that is transmitted to the neshama of a person. Yes, it goes through the gray matter of the brain, but that's not where it stops. And adarav, if a child wouldn't learn Torah when he's an embryo from a malach, he wouldn't be able to incorporate and integrate Torah from the gray matter of his brain, because Torah is not just a subject. It's not just physical material knowledge. It's spiritual knowledge. And therefore, it has to impact on the spiritual side of a person. So if that spiritual knowledge wasn't implanted in a person by a malach, he wouldn't be able to learn Torah afterwards. He's just regaining and accessing the Torah that he got from that malach before he was born. So therefore, teaching a child who on the surface seems like he can't learn because he is disabled mentally in some way, but that means that you're relegating the Torah to just another kind of wisdom. And it's not. It's a spiritual thing. And teaching a child even a child who may show that mentally doesn't grasp, but you don't know what's going into his neshama. And that body is only a temporary clothing, right? The radio's broken, but you don't know how much you're affecting that person, even though his radio's broken. What's going into his neshama? So a person who denies the fact that Torah can be transmitted neshama-wise is going to be cursed by the embryos, because you're implying that they can't learn Torah then. In addition, when we speak about education, educating a child for Torah and mitzvahs, there are two aspects to mitzvahs. There's what's called the Melech Mitzav El Ha'am, the king commanding his subjects. God is the king, and the king wants obedience for the sake of the... It's good to be an obedient person, a civilized and disciplined person. The Ron Hashem wants people to be disciplined, to be able to make good moral choices. So he gave us things to do. And if we are disciplined and accept authority, he'll reward us as the king. And if we go against his authority and we rebel, he'll punish us as the king. Then the reward and punishment is extrinsic to the mitzvah. The mitzvah itself may have no benefit at all. It's just that God wants you to fulfill that command. And if you fulfill the command, you'll get rewarded for being an obedient servant. Okay, imagine a king who commands the people in his realm, nobody's allowed to eat watermelon. He wants to show his authority, right? And he's doing it for the sake of the people. They should be people who can accept authority. Nobody's allowed to eat watermelon. You eat watermelon, you get your head cut off. Somebody eats watermelon, the watermelon's not going to harm him. But if the king catches him, he's going to cut his head off. So the punishment comes from outside the action itself. There's another aspect of Torah and mitzvahs, and that is rofe miyayitz esachola. The doctor advises patients. Somebody comes to a doctor, he's examined. The doctor says, I see that you're allergic to watermelon. Deathly allergic. If you eat watermelon, within 20 minutes you'll be dead. So I very strongly advise you not to eat watermelon. Here, if the person eats watermelon, the doctor's not going to punish him. The watermelon's going to punish him. It's the watermelon itself that is detrimental to the person. The Rabban Hashem created the world, and he told us, look, these things are vitamins for your neshama and your body. And these things are deathly. They're poison. If you don't listen to the Rabban Hashem, the thing itself is going to punish you. He's not going to punish you. But doing the Aveira itself is the punishment. Doing the mitzvah is itself the reward. The Tzitzis Rosh Yeshiva says that most mitzvahs and averas have both aspects to them, the king and the doctor. There are certain exceptions. Okay, for our purposes now, that's enough to understand. And therefore, certain children are not capable of receiving the command of the king. They're not capable of understanding commands, of being disciplined like that, because they're basically, what's it called, handicapped. Handicapped either physically, they can't fulfill that command, or mentally, and they can't understand or deal or function, right, with great discipline. They're not capable of that. So they're not going to get rewarded or punished, or teaching them is not going to affect this. They may be exempt from those mitzvahs because the command doesn't apply to them. But on the other hand, doing those mitzvahs and not doing those averas may still benefit their neshama because of the intrinsic value of the mitzvah and the intrinsic detriment of the avera. So there's two ideas in chinuch. One, to train a child to be able to obey commands and fulfill commands. And the other one is to see to it that the child does things that are good for its neshama, even if it can't function with the command. So it's possible that a child who is exempt from Torah and mitzvahs on a certain level, but on another level, there's still an idea to protect that child from doing averas and to encourage that child to do mitzvahs, even if they're not going to be rewarded or punished because they're not capable of following a command. But the benefit of the mitzvah and the detriment of the aveira is still there. With that in mind, we will explain what the guidelines of chinuch are for a regular person, and see then how it applies to handicapped people. There is a mitzvah to educate children, to teach them how to fulfill positive commandments, and to educate them not to transgress negative commandments. When it comes to positive commandments, the mitzvah applies for different mitzvahs and for different children at different times. The basic rule is the child has to be capable physically to fulfill that mitzvah, right? He has to have the motor dexterity or whatever to do a mitzvah. Let's take an example, lulav. Okay, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of lulav, you have to be able to hold a lulav and esrog in your hands, right? Obviously, an infant's not going to be able to do that. You also have to know how to shake that esrog and lulav properly to all four directions, not take it and use it as a broom, or poke people's eyes out with it, okay? So you have to know how to hold it properly, how to shake it properly, and that is the mitzvah of lulav. When are you required to educate a child, buy your child a lulav and esrog, and educate him how to do it? When he's capable of doing it. When he's capable of holding an esrog and lulav without blinding himself and other people around him, and being able to hold it and shake it properly. If he can do that, he doesn't have to understand all the deep mysteries of what esrog and lulav represent. He just has to be able to do the action. When he's able to do the action, then you train him. Tzitzis, maybe a little bit easier. Right, tzitzis, you just have to know how to wear a garment, keep two tzitzis in the front and two in the back, right? And when you're capable of doing that, you have the mitzvah tzitzis. That may be a younger age. Usually the age where a child is capable physically and mentally of fulfilling mitzvahs that have to do predominantly with action is about 5-6 years old. That is the age of chinuch for mitzvahs asei that are dependent on action. Then there are other mitzvahs that aren't dependent just on an action, but they're dependent on an action that represents a concept, an idea. Kiddush. Right? Just taking a cup of wine in your hand and saying a bunch of words is not kiddush. Kiddush means you sanctify the Shabbos. So a person who can hold a goblet in his hand, right, and mumble a few words isn't yet capable of making kiddush because he doesn't know what he's doing. There, a child has to be a little bit older to understand the concept of there's a holy day in the week and we are saying Kiddush to make that day special. He doesn't have to understand the depth of what Kiddush represents. Just that simple idea. This is a special day. We are making a special bracha on a special cup of wine to show that that day is special. Same thing with Havdalah. Same thing with Arba Kosos. It's not just drinking a cup of wine or grape juice. That's the mitzvah. The mitzvah is drinking it because you're free. So you have to understand the concept of freedom, at least that much. So that a child has to be a little bit older. Wait. For those kind of mitzvahs, a child has to be a little bit older, have a little bit more understanding, and usually for those mitzvahs, a child has to be 6 or 7. And again, it depends on the child. So there are precocious children who could be even younger ages to understand these things. And there are slower children that maybe have to be a little bit older to understand these things. But for a normal child, the first kind of mitzvah is around 5 or 6, the second kind of mitzvah is around 6 or 7. How about prohibitions? Okay? Child shouldn't eat something that's not kosher. Shouldn't do something that's asur on Shabbos. There, the child doesn't have to be so mature as he has to be for a mitzvah saseh. He has to just understand the idea of we don't do that now. Okay, not just that you tell him, don't eat this thing now, and he understands my mother or father said, don't do it now, and that's it. Right? But he doesn't understand that that same thing tomorrow he shouldn't eat either. He has to be able to understand that this kind of thing we don't do. And we don't, there's an idea of one day a week when there's a Shabbos, and there's certain things we don't do on Shabbos, right? Children, everything, it's muktzah, right? That's the blanket thing for anything that's also on Shabbos, is muktzah, it's muktzah. So when a child can understand there's muktzah, and muktzah is not on Tuesday or Wednesday, but there's a Shabbos, and he understands the days of the week, and that usually a child is between 4 and 5 years old, already has a concept of time, concept of things, the differences between different things. These are the kind of food we eat. This is the kind of foods that we don't eat. Right? A child between 4 and 5 already is capable of being educated not to do things that are prohibited. So those are the mitzvah, and that mitzvah applies only to parents. You don't have to educate other people's children. You have to educate your own children. So you have a mitzvah to teach your children how to do positive commandments, and you have a mitzvah to see to it that they don't do negative commandments when they reach this age. Before that age, before they are capable of understanding bichlal, what Shabbos is all about. They don't understand the difference between Tuesday, Wednesday, or Saturday. It's all the same to them. Right? Every day they wake up, they don't understand a different day. It's all the same. So they're under that age, right? So then there is no mitzvah even on a parent to stop a child from doing something awesome. Right? A child does something on Shabbos for themselves, right? And they'll be lower than that age where they can understand anything. A parent doesn't have to stop their children. Other people, so the halacha is when a child is of educationable age and we're talking about him doing something wrong from the Torah, he's eating chazer, and he's already of an educationable age, 4 or 5 years old, he understands that chazer is osur, that there are certain things that are not permitted to eat, right? Then, the halacha, even a stranger, even somebody not a parent, has to stop that child from eating something or doing something that's prohibited by the Torah. But he doesn't have to stop the child from doing something that's prohibited only rabbinically. The exception to that is that if the child is not of an educationable age, and the child is doing something that, well, let's go to that in a second. So in any case, but a parent has to stop his child from doing something rabbinically prohibited, Torah prohibited, makes no difference, once he has the age at least 4 or 5 years old. Before that, he doesn't have to stop. But it's part of the education. If you have to train a child, surely you have to stop him from doing something wrong. Okay. If the child, what he's doing wrong, causes damage, or causes some kind of takola or whatever, right, there even some people should stop a child who's breaking windows, even if he's a 2-year-old. Right, he's causing other people damage. But for the child's sake, if the child is of an educationable age, everybody has to stop him from doing something wrong. If it's a Torah prohibition, if it's only a rabbinic prohibition, only the parents are required to stop him. Teaching the child to do mitzvahs is only the obligation of the parents, and it starts for each mitzvah according to the age that the child is capable of doing that mitzvah, and mitzvahs that need certain understanding the concept of the mitzvah. To give a child something that is prohibited makes no difference if it's prohibited from the Torah or prohibited rabbinically. No one is allowed to give a child something, to make him do something that's prohibited. To take a child, what's it called, and take him by the hands, you want a light put on Shabbos, right? You can't take the child and put him, what's it called, up to a light switch and take his hand and make sure that he turns on the light. You're causing that child, even a one-day-old infant, you can't do that to him. If the child does it on his own, then it's a matter of not stopping him. If he's not educational age, you can let a child play around the light switch. You want the light on, as long as he doesn't know he's doing it for you. He's doing it because he's playing or because he's doing it for himself. You don't have to stop him, even if you're the parent, if he's under the age of education. Okay. But to give him to do it as a shiloh, what that means? Does that mean to put it in his... You can't give a child something that's prohibited to eat. So what does that mean? Put it in his mouth? That for sure. How about put it in front of him where you know for sure that he's going to eat it? According to many opinions, that is also usur. In time of need, one can put something in front of a child that's usur, right? As long as it doesn't cause the child to actually eat it. Or anything similar to that with Hilchos Shabbos or whatever. Okay, so that's by a normal, regular child. These are the basic guidelines of chinuch. How does that apply now to children who are impaired? And there's a cheirish and a shote and a kot, and they're grouped together usually, so the same halachas apply to them. Basically, first let's define a shote. A real shote is a person who is either insane. Insane means he's irrational. That means it's not a matter that his intelligence is impaired. There are many shotim, many insane people who are geniuses. I knew one insane person years ago in Cleveland, that he was a walking calendar. He could tell you any year, 100 years from now. You tell him the date, he'll tell you what day of the week it is. He was a genius. It was in a photographic memory, and somehow he memorized the calendar system. And he knew it. He was insane. The child was completely not a rational being. Couldn't make rational decisions. He was irrational. Okay? That's one kind of shota. A person like that is exempt from the whole Torah, because he can't make moral decisions. Sometimes a person can be irrational, and sometimes he can have rational moments. When he's rational, he's required to keep the Torah. When he's irrational, he's not. That's a shote. Another kind of shote is a person who's not only limited in his intellect, but he basically has such a low intellect, of the intellect of an infant. He can't think. His level of intelligence is basically infantile. That's another kind of shota. A child who has limited intelligence, retarded intelligence. So it depends. If he has the intelligence of a 4 or 5 year old, even if he's 15 years old, but just as a 4 and 5 year old, there's a mitzvah of chinuch, because that child can understand that it's Shabbos, and we don't do things, certain things on Shabbos, and this is something that's prohibited to eat. If the child has that intelligence, then he's not a shota. He's just normal intelligence, of lesser intelligence, but that lesser intelligence can be dealt with agabe isurim. If he has a little bit more, he has the intelligence of a 5 or 6 year old. Then he can be taught mitzvahs. A 6 or 7 year old even taught in the other mitzvahs. A child basically who has the intelligence of a 6 or 7 year old, where all the mitzvahs of chinuch would apply to a child of that age. So an adult of that age is bar mitzvah. He's chayiv to keep mitzvahs, and you have to educate him and see to it that he keeps mitzvahs according to the level of a 6 or 7 year old. Because a 6 and 7 year old child is educationable at that age with that kind of intelligence. So an adult with intelligence like that is also not a shota. He's called a pesi. He's a slow, low intelligence person. But you don't have to be a high intelligence person to keep the Torah. So if he's capable of what a normal child would be of educationable age for either prohibitions, for physical mitzvahs, for mitzvahs that involve concepts, that's what you're required to do for a person like that, even if he's 100 years old. And a child like that also. Right? If he's a child, he's over bar mitzvah, or she's over bas mitzvah, right? Then they are legally adults. They can be counted for a child, a boy can be counted for a minyan, for a mezumen, right? They're chayiv in mitzvahs, the mitzvahs they can do. The mitzvahs they can't do, so they're anusim. They are, what's it called, incapable of doing it. The Torah doesn't demand somebody to do something they can't do. Same thing goes for physical impurities. A child that, what's it called, Rahman al-Son, somebody doesn't have arms, can't put on tefillin. Somebody who has no control over their arms. It's impossible for them to put on, could be the potter from tefillin altogether. A child like that. And so too with all the other mitzvahs. A mitzvah that a person can do physically, he's required to do. A mitzvah that he can't do physically, so he's exempt from that mitzvah. He's anonymous. He's in the parsha, but he can't do it. So it's not that he's not required to do it, but he's chayef to do it as like anybody else, except he has a good reason why he's exempt, because he can't do it. The acheresh, a deaf, mute, person who's only deaf who can speak, is a normal person, depending on what his intelligence is. It's a person who can not speak, but hear, also has the same din of a regular person, depends on his mental capabilities. A deaf mute, there the Torah said that for whatever reason, a person who can't speak or hear is to a certain degree out of reality, and is considered like a shota. Bisman hazeh, where there are methods, first of all, there's hearing aids, that even maybe a deaf person can somehow hear something. And there are ways of teaching deaf mutes to speak some way, even if not intelligible to everyone. But, right? And definitely there are deaf mutes who are very, very astute. So it could be that, especially if he can speak or she can speak minimally, right? They're not considered anymore a deaf mute completely. They don't have the din of a shota, and then it depends on what's it called, on what their capabilities are, the gabi mitzvahs. And they can be counted as a minion and so on. This is a very gray area, because here it's clear that the Torah said deaf mute is exempt from mitzvahs like a shota. But it's very possible that since today it's possible to help and aid the hearing and the speaking, so then that person is no longer a pure deaf mute and is no longer under that cloud that a deaf mute is has a din of a shota. In any case, a parent has a responsibility. Most Down syndrome children have limited but enough intelligence to be able to do mitzvahs, not to do averis, and the level of depends again on the retardation, right? Not in Down syndrome, but other things. Right, but a child that has the intelligence of a 6 or 7 year old, or an adult who has an intelligence of a 6 or 7 year old, is chayiv in mitzvahs and has to be educated to mitzvahs like any other child, even though it may not be as easy. And therefore, even a child that doesn't have that intelligence, there's a shaila whether you're allowed to give that child something that's aser. And the consensus pretty much is that even if there's a chance that that child one day can be taught and brought up, the level can be brought up, or the child will listen. The child at least has that basic idea of what, or someday it'll be able to listen and be obedient. You can't give that child an iser, just like you can't give an infant something usher. But there, sometimes say, because one day he'll be an adult, right? So therefore you can't even give it to him when he's a child. But a child will never become an adult, meaning he'll never have the intelligence of an adult. There's a shaila. Basically, Moshe Feinstein, the Chassam Sofer, had a shaila of a girl who was what's it called, a shota. But there was a chance that they could teach her and bring her level of intelligence up. The question was to put her into an institution where they would feed her treif. And the Chassam Sofer advised against it. But in that situation, there was a chance that the level of the intelligent child could be brought up, And therefore eating treif is matamtim mishalev, would affect her adversely, and would affect the ability of getting her to a level where she would be able to understand. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that in a situation where there's no hope, child is meant, what's it called, physically brain damaged or whatever, there's no chance that that child will ever be brought to a higher level of intelligence, and they're below the level of even understanding what is usher and what's mutter, then putting a child like that in an institution like that is okay. Because the child will never reach a level where they'll be able to be educated or be chayav in mitzvahs. And if that's what's best for that child, that's what's mutter. In any case, that is the basics of what the guidelines for chinuch, mitzvahs, prohibitions are for normal children, and memela for children who are similar, have similar mental capabilities, even if they're not children. Okay. How much time should a person put in to teaching? How much money into at the expense of other children in the family? I can't answer that question in a generic way. It really depends on the dynamics of the family. It depends on what the repercussions will be to that child if you don't put that extra in. Where are they going to be? And what's going to be the repercussions to the other members of the family if you don't put it into them? And then when you know all the dynamics and you can weigh all the different possibilities, then you can come to a decision. Is it generic? There's no generic rule to those things. It really depends on. And also, sometimes parents should realize that they are not the sole responsibility. It's the responsibility of a parent to educate their children who are minors. Once a child becomes a gadol, the parent's responsibility is diminished. And with these kind of children who are basically adults, right, and just that there's a mitzvah now to teach them or whatever, basically it's a communal responsibility, not only the parents' own responsibility. And there should be organizations like this, Fathers Connect, and then other organizations created, and help given by the community to parents, right, as I hear that the government gives help like that. Maybe not enough, but government never gives enough in anybody's eyes. But in any case, they give help to help the parents alleviate the burden on their shoulders and spread it to other people, either people who are volunteer or people can be paid to help or whatever, and free up a lot of the time, at least, that parents can give to their other children, their other needs, and even sometimes the money that can be used for other things when the money may come from the community or whatever to aid parents who have this burden. I'll give you an example of a question that I was asked. Mr. Stromberg sent me some questions from various people. And give you one example. A person has a daughter who's 29 years old. She's wheelchair bound with cerebral palsy and has no use of her left arm and hand. The father was advised once that his daughter, who was of normal intelligence and speech, so she's required to keep mitzvahs, right, that she can, is obligated to do netilas yadayim on two hands before motzi and coming out of the bathroom. Someone must always be with the girl to assist her, since only one hand is functional. She can't possibly wash both of her hands because one hand is dysfunctional completely. So somebody has to be with her all the time to wash her hands before a meal, before she comes out of the bathroom or whatever. The father is angry about being so bound up by the halacha. Is this a correct ruling? In my eyes, this is absurd. I don't know who told the person to do this, but it's for sure not what I would have told the person to do. For two reasons. First of all, there is no halacha, nikar ad-din, that when a person leaves the bathroom, he has to wash with a cup and pour the water three times over his hand. The person wants to do that, it's a nice hiddur. But it's not a halacha. So that's for sure. This girl goes to the bathroom, she can turn on the faucet with her normal hand, and wash both hands underneath the faucet herself. That's for sure. That's no shyly. I don't know why somebody ever said that somebody has to accompany her, you know, and, after the bathroom and wash her hands like Nagel does. In the morning, yeah, it's for sure preferable that somebody should wash her hands three times with a kli, right? That's one time when she gets up in the morning, and that's it. For eating, there are other etzes, right? They are not normal situations. They are only done under duress situations. This is a duress situation. Okay, a person can't find water, right, within a certain amount of distance, so he's allowed to wear gloves or eat with a utensil that's not normally used for eating, like a wooden spoon or something like that, and doesn't have to wash for motzi. Can eat bread without washing. Certain times, just even putting a glove on the hand itself is okay. So this situation, for sure, the girl could cover her hands. Surely eating with a utensil that's not normally used 100% for eating purposes makes it even better. It could be you don't even need that, right? But if they would ask me the Shaila Lamaisa, I would look into it more. But there definitely are aitzes for this girl not to have somebody around her all the time washing her hands. The only time that she would have to wash really is in the morning. And even there, if somebody washes in the morning, she should have in mind that the whole day that washing will help even for eating bread. And then all the other things are hidurim, to wear gloves, whatever. But there are definitely other possibilities that would make this much more easy to handle and still fulfill the halacha. So I don't know who told this person that the girl needs this and made it oppressive. But there are ways, many times, of not getting around the halacha, but understanding the limitations of the person, and because of that, the halacha doesn't change, but there are accommodations for those kinds of situations. In other situations, they apply here also. Another question, a delicate question. A child who is impaired, what's it called, mentally, intellectually. And the child, therefore, maybe can't be taught certain mitzvahs, and not of an age where certain mitzvahs they can do, or certain prohibitions they can stop from. So again, you're not allowed to give them those prohibitions, but you don't have to necessarily stop them from doing those if they're not capable of understanding or controlling themselves. And therefore, certain sexual averas, people masturbate, which is an avera. Okay, but a child who can be told, and even that's difficult sometimes for children to understand or whatever, right? But there's a certain age where you can speak to a child, lecture them, explain to them, or whatever, it's not a proper thing to do or whatever. But a child who is mentally impaired, most of the time probably not going to be able to explain to that child, and they basically going to follow their basic animal urges and do what's pleasurable to them. To instruct a child like that to do that, because it lessens the pressure on the child or whatever, that's awesome. That's called safin and leisur, that's awesome. That's directing the child to do something awesome. But to put a blind eye and not stop the child, right, considering the fact that the child is not of age where he can be educated, and he's not of the mental capability of being educated, you don't have to stop the child either. So that would be, in that situation, right, he's not obligated to stop his special child from touching himself, but on the other hand, he surely can't instruct the child and be a party to the child doing this, because he feels that it's good for the child to release a lot of his tensions or whatever in that way. That not. Some of these other questions, because obligation of chinuch, we explained. Am I obligated to spend time teaching my special needs child Torah and mitzvahs when it's questionable if he or she will ever understand or be able to apply it in his adult life? Especially my special needs child requires so much more time to learn, which I give it to him will take away from my own learning. Like we said, Again, the balance depends really on the specific situation. But is there a chiyuv yet? If a child is least of an age, a mental age of 6 or 7, then when they become an adult, they'll be chayav in mitzvahs too, the mitzvahs they can do. And there's a mitzvah to educate them to those mitzvahs also. How do I balance giving a disproportionate amount of my time to my special needs child who may not grow very much, when the same time spent with my typical child may move him great distances? Again, I can't give a generic answer to that. I have to know what the implications are for the child that doesn't have special needs, what the special needs child, like, how much time to balance it, where each one will get, what the repercussions of not getting it would not be disastrous. Same thing with money. Disproportionate amount of money I have to spend on my special needs child. My typical daughter needs money for a shidduch. How do I set priorities? Again, that's a very personal, individual question that depends on the situation in that family. How much money we're talking about, how to split it up, balance it is something they can't... Here's a question that applies even to regular children. I don't know why it's only by special needs. We have a foster care for our 18-year-old special needs son since he was 1 month old. He's an adopted child who's now 18 years old. What are the rules in Nagia, in particular touching and hugging his mother and sister? Okay. So here this question comes up, Bichlau, by what's it called, by adopted children. Right? Somebody who raised an adopted child from infancy. I'm not talking where you adopted him when he was 18. It's a different story. You adopted him when he was a few months old. Then, according to most poskim, he can hug and kiss his mother even when he's over bar mitzvah. Some hold that once he's bar mitzvah, he shouldn't. But there is good reason, right, that if that mother raised that boy or a father raised a girl from the time they were infants, the idea of... Even though it's not a biological child, but the father has those fatherly feelings for that daughter, because he raised her for an infancy as a father, or the mother for the son, and therefore their hugging and kissing is not the kind of hugging and kissing that's prohibited. It's 100% permitted. Between brothers and sisters, a different story. Until they're bar and bas mitzvah, I would let them function, but even brothers and sisters who are mamish blood relations, beyond bar mitzvah is not a good idea for brothers and sisters to hug and kiss each other. And therefore, here's surely there's a reason to be machmir. Yichud is a different story. To be miyachid with an adopted child, right? There it's a halacha, has nothing to do with what the intentions are or whatever. And there are definitely most poskim hold you can't have yichud, but there are ways of seeing to it that the isser doesn't apply, right? Various ways, and somebody who has that situation should ask a shaila how he can circumvent the problem of yichud, where there won't be yichud and it still won't affect the normal family relations. Okay. How are we supposed to relate to the term Schere Shota Pesi with our developmentally delayed children? I think I covered that. What are the guidelines for including by bar mitzvah age special needs son in a minyan or a zimun? Again, a child who has the intelligence even of a 6 or 7 year old, when becomes an adult, is bar mitzvah, can count for a minyan, can what's it called be part of a mezumen, is 100% regular, normal adult Jew. Girl, the same thing. My adult age special needs son davens at school every day. In fact, he's been chosen to lead the davening there. Shabbos Mincha, my son never misses going because the Gabbai has made a kesher with my son and lets him do Hagbah almost every week. On Shabbos morning, however, my son wants to sleep in. Should I push him to go to shul for Shacharis? At home, he davens Shacharis in about 3 to 5 minutes. So here again, it depends on what the capabilities of that child are. A child can make Hagbah, doesn't necessarily able to daven Shemone Esrei. And a child who's not capable of davening Shemone Esrei is not of the educational age to daven Shemone Esrei. Right? He doesn't have the zitzflesh and he's not capable of concentrating or whatever. So that mitzvah doesn't apply. And therefore, even a child who's an adult, whose mental capabilities and ability to concentrate and to stay in one place right, doesn't exist, and he's not responsible for that mitzvah. And therefore, encourage him to do what he can do, and don't make him do things that are not he's not capable of doing. Okay. My special needs daughter is 6. At what age or level of understanding would it no longer be appropriate for her to accompany me on the men's side of the Kosel? Okay, the problem over here is not her understanding. The problem is the men. So the basic halacha is like this. According to the Mishnah Berurah, a girl of 3 years old already has all the halachas of an adult girl, right? Legabe inyone arayas, yichud, or whatever. She has to dress tzanua, and whatever. The Chazon Ish and the Mai Rebbeim, the Telzer Rosh Yeshiva, also held differently. They held that a girl, until she's around 6, 7, maybe 8, and she begins to start to look like a young lady and not a little girl, these halachas don't apply. So basically, I'm the Rav in Moshav Matityahu, we say that a father can bring his daughter into the men's section even when she's over 3. However, once she's 3, he can't bring her into the men's section unless she's dressed properly, where the way a tzanua girl has to dress. She doesn't have to dress outside the shul like that, according to us, until she's 6 or 7. Till 6 or 7, not like the Mishnah Berurah says, but more like the Chazon Ish and more like my Rebbeim, that a girl who's less than 6 or 7 does not yet have to dress tzanua. She doesn't have to have longer sleeves. She can have shorter dresses or whatever, because she's still a little kid. She's not a young, not starting to look like a young lady. So that's looking already somewhere around 7, 8 years old, around there. The same thing applies to a special needs child. It doesn't make a difference on what the girl knows, right? It's how the men are going to look at her. And if she already starts to look like a young lady, even though her mental age is 3, she can't be brought into the men's section. Right? If she doesn't yet look like a young lady, she's impaired maybe physically also, then even an older age can be brought in. It really doesn't depend on the girl's mental prowess. It depends really on her look. What determines what kind of bar mitzvah preparation I give my special needs son? The same thing that depends what bar mitzvah preparation you give your not special needs son. Because every son is a special need, right? In some places, every child lanes the whole parsha. And a child who doesn't lane the whole parsha feels like he is second class. That is a terrible, terrible thing to do to a child. Not every child can lane a whole parsha, right? Some children are very fine, but they just don't have a memory to lane, or they're not musically inclined, and they can't do it. To force them to do it and to waste a half a year with lessons to that is a avla to that child. You're wasting his time for things he could be doing better, and you're making him do something that's oppressive to him. So, my own children, some of them laned, some of them laned one parsha, whatever they could do. And whatever the child can do, that's what they should be encouraged to do, so they feel that they accomplish something. But not there should be a communal standard that everybody has to live up to, where they feel like they're second rate. And in shuls where they have that idea, it's a terrible, terrible avla to children. And I think in most places now they understand that's not the case. Parents should not force their children to do things they can't do. They should more encourage them to do things they can do and that they feel they accomplish something. So if a child can't learn to lane, let him say a nicer Dvar Torah, if he can do that. Right? Let him learn something and make a seum, right? If he can do that. Whatever it is. The same thing goes with a special needs child. We had a child, when I was a Rav here in Har Nof, a Down syndrome child that has bar mitzvah, and he laned the first aliyah. And it took him a long time to learn it, but he wanted to do it. And we didn't make him lane more than that, and he laned, and you could be Yotzei, right? People had tears in their eyes. Right? They were Yotzei l'mahadrin. Maybe not, because they heard every word they heard enough to be Yotzei the Kriya. If the child couldn't lane, that anybody could understand him, right, then he wouldn't be allowed to lane. It's not for him to something to do. Let him do something else that he can do. But this child could enunciate the words enough that they were close enough to the real word to be Yotze, and the child wanted very much to do it, and one aliyah he could do, and that child felt like the king of the world, that he could do something just like everybody else could do it. That was kedai. If the child can't do it, then don't force him to do something because the parent wants to show him off. It's not for the sake of the parents, for the sake of the child. So it applies not only to special needs children, it applies to all children. Whatever the child can do, let him do and feel that he accomplished something. And not to feel he's a failure. And do it in such a way that after shul, people are going to be complaining about what he did, and the kid will feel that he's a failure. That not. Okay, if anybody else has any other questions, not specific questions about your specific case, that's something you should ask your own Rav who knows you, who knows your child, who knows your family, right? Not some stranger like me who doesn't know you, doesn't know your family, doesn't know your situation, and would be a fool to answer your question, and therefore, if I answer your question, you don't want to hear my answer because it's foolish. And if I'm not a fool, I won't answer your question, so there's no tachlis of asking it. Okay. But some more general questions or whatever, you're more happy to answer. Yeah.
For a child who can count in the Nesuim or Birchot, how do we determine if the child can be Motzi? What
to be Motzi someone else, he has to know what he's doing. He has to know what benching is, okay? And know how to bench properly, enunciate the words properly. And if he's an adult and he knows that, then he could be Motzi people too. He's a Bar Chiyuva, right? In other words, once we say he's a Bar Mitzvah, he's a Bar Chiyuva. He has to bench and he could be Motzi other people are benching. If he's not of that level, right? So then he's not a Bar Chiyuva. Maybe he can't be Motzi somebody else either. If he can be taught like a parrot to parrot the words, but he has no idea what he's doing because his intelligence isn't like that, then he's not a Bar Mitzvah. Maybe he can't be Motzi anybody like that. Any other questions? Anybody up there? Okay, I appreciate your giving me this opportunity. I hope that I accomplish something here. I hope that you're going away more mechuzik and more with more understanding than you came here. And I'd be happy if people want to ask me privately or whatever, not necessarily now, but on the phone or whatever, more than happy to give you as much chizik as I can. I probably will get a lot more chizik from speaking to you than you'll get from me. So I appreciate that also. Do you have a number? I have a number. Okay. Color.
I have just a quick question. What about in the tradition, it talks about a man to teach his son a trade? Can the child with special needs?
The what?
To teach a child a trade. This is in Kiddushin.
Teaching a trade? So here again, it depends what the child's capable of doing. But I know many special needs children who can hold a regular job and other, be very productive. Right, it depends on, right?
Same,
depends on the child.
Same principle.
Okay. Mm-hmm. My son is a Kohen. And
would that be Duchening?
No, alone. If he's the only Kohen, and he knows what...
And he can say the words, yes, and people can understand them?
Yes.
How old is he?
16.
And he's capable of understanding,
down,
right? Yeah.
He's high functioning down
syndrome. Yeah, for sure he can down a good
as the only, without his,
and he's Dosh Be'iro, everybody knows him, everybody in the shul, everybody, what's
yes.
It called?